There were two other things she said on the way back, one with her mouth and one with her eyes. The one she said out loud was that she'd been thinking of packing her things and running away. That seemed at least like a way out. But running won't solve your problems if you've been hurt bad enough. Wherever you run, you take your head and your heart with you, after all. And the thing I saw in her eyes was that the thought of suicide had done more than just cross her mind. I'd think of that, of seeing the thought of suicide in my daughter's eyes. And then I'd see Joe's face even clearer with that eye inside me. I'd see how he must have looked, pestering her and pestering her, trying to get a hand up under her skirt until she wore nothing but jeans in self-defense, not getting what he wanted, or not all of what he wanted, because of simple luck, her good and his bad, and not for any lack of trying. I thought about what might have happened if Joe Jr. hadn't cut his playing with Willie Bramhall short a few times and come home early, or if I hadn't finally opened my eyes enough to get a really good look at her. Most of all, I thought about how he'd driven her. He'd done it the way a bad-hearted man with a quirt or a greenwood stick might drive a horse, and never stop once, not for love and not for pity, until that animal lay dead at his feet. And him probably standing above it with a stick in his hand, wondering why in hell that happened. This was where wanting to touch his forehead, wanting to see if it felt as smooth as it looked, had gotten me. This was where it all come out. My eyes were all the way open, and I saw I was living with a loveless, pitiless man who believed anything he could reach with his arm and grasp with his hand was his to take, even his own daughter. I'd gotten just about that far in my thinking when the thought of killing him crossed my mind for the first time. That wasn't when I made up my mind to do it. Gory, no. But I'd be a liar if I said the thought was only a daydream. It was a lot more than that. Selina must have seen some of that in my eyes, because she laid her hand on my arm and says, "Is there going to be trouble, Mommy? Please say there isn't. He'll know I told, and he'll be mad." I wanted to soothe her heart by telling her what she wanted to hear, but I couldn't. There was going to be trouble. Just how much and how bad would probably be up to Joe. He'd backed down that night I hit him with the creamer, but that didn't mean he would again. "I don't know what's going to happen," I said, "but I'll tell you two things, Selina. None of this is your fault, and his days of pawing and pestering you are over. Do you understand?" Her eyes filled up with tears again, and one of them spilled over and rolled down her cheek. "I just don't want there to be trouble," she said. She stopped a minute, her mouth working, and then she busts out, "Oh, I hate this. Why did you ever hit him? Why did he ever have to start up with me? Why couldn't things stay like they were?" I took her hand. "Things never do, honey. Sometimes they go wrong and then they have to be fixed. You know that, don't you?" She nodded her head. I saw pain in her face, but no doubt. "Yes," she said, "I guess I do." We were coming into the dock then, and there was no more time for talk. I was just as glad. I didn't want her looking at me with those tearful eyes of hers, wanting what I guess every kid wants, for everything to be made right, but with no pain and nobody hurt. Wanting me to make promises I couldn't make, because they were promises I didn't know if I could keep. I wasn't sure that inside eye would let me keep them. We got off the ferry without another word passing between us, and that was just as fine as paint with me. That evening, after Joe got home from the Carstairs place where he was building a back porch, I sent all three kids down to the market. I saw Selina casting little glances back at me all the way down the drive, and her face was just as pale as a glass of milk. Every time she turned her head, Andy, I saw that double-damned hatchet in her eyes. But I saw something else in them, too, and I believe that other thing was relief. "At least things are going to quit just going around and around like they have been," she must have been thinking. Scared as she was, I think part of her must have been thinking that. Joe was sitting by the stove reading the American like he done every night. I stood by the wood box, looking at him, and that eye inside seemed to open wider than ever. Look at him, I thought, sitting there like the grand high poobah of upper butt crack. Sitting there like he didn't have to put on his pants one leg at a time like the rest of us. Sitting there as if putting his hands all over his only daughter was the most natural thing in all the world, and any man could sleep easy after doing it. I tried to think of how we'd gotten from the junior-senior prom at the Samoset Inn to where we were right now. Him sitting by the stove and reading the paper in his old patched blue jeans and dirty thermal undershirt, and me standing by the wood box with murder in my heart. And I couldn't do it. It was like being in a magic forest where you look back over your shoulder and see the path has disappeared behind you. Meantime, that inside eye saw more and more. It saw the crisscross scars on his ear from when I hit him with the creamer. It saw the squiggly little veins in his nose. It saw the way his lower lip pushed out so he almost always looked like he was having a fit of the sulks. It saw the dandruff in his eyebrows, and the way he'd pull at the hairs growing out of his nose, or give his pants a good tug at the crotch every now and then. All the things that I saw were bad, and it come to me that marrying him had been a lot more than the biggest mistake of my life. It was the only mistake that really mattered, because it wasn't just me that would end up paying for it. It was Selena he was occupied with then, but there were two boys coming along right behind her, and if he wouldn't stop at trying to rape their big sister, what might he do to them? I turned my head, and that eye inside saw the hatchet, laying on the shelf over the wood box just the same as always. I reached out for it and closed my fingers around the handle, thinking, I ain't gonna put it in your hand this time, Joe. Your head, maybe, but not your hand. Then I thought of Selena turning back to look at me as the three of them walked down the driveway, and I decided that whatever happened, the goddamn hatchet wasn't going to be any part of it. I bent down and took a chunk of rock maple out of the wood box instead. Hatchet or stove length, it almost didn't matter. Joe's life come within a whisker of ending right then and there. The longer I looked at him sitting in his dirty shirt, tugging at the hairs sticking out of his nose and reading the funny pages, the more I thought of what he'd been up to with Selena. The more I thought about that, the madder I got. The madder I got, the closer I came to just walking over there and breaking his skull open with that stick of wood. I could even see the place I'd hit the first lick. His hair had started to get real thin, especially in back, and the light from the lamp beside his chair made a kind of gleam there. You could see the freckles on the skin between the few strands of hair that was left. Right there, I thought. That very place. The blood'll jump up and spatter all over the lampshade, but I don't care. It's an ugly old thing anyway. The more I thought about it, the more I wanted to see the blood flying up onto the shade like I knew it would. And then I thought about how drops would fly onto the light bulb, too, and make a little sizzling sound. I thought about those things, and the more I thought, the more my fingers bore down on that chunk of stove wood, getting their best grip. It was crazy. Oh, yes. But I couldn't seem to turn away from him. And I knew that inside eye would go on looking at him, even if I did. I told myself to think about how Selena would look at me if I did it. How her eyes would say that my temper was every bit as bad as Joe had said it was, and all her worst fears had come true. But that didn't work either. As much as I loved her, and as much as I wanted her good regard, it didn't. That eye was too strong for love. Not even wondering what would happen to the three of them if he was dead and I was in South Windham for killing him would make that inside eye close up. It stayed wide open, and it kept seeing more and more ugly things in Joe's face. The way he scraped white flakes of skin up from his cheeks when he shaved. A blob of mustard from his dinner drying on his chin. His big old horsey dentures, which he got from mail order and didn't fit him right. And every time I saw something else with that eye, my grip on that stove length would tighten down a little more. At the last minute, I thought of something else. If you do this right here and right now, you won't be doing it for Selena, I thought. You wouldn't be doing it for the boys, either. You'd be doing it because all that grabbing was going on under your very nose for 3 months or more, and you was too dumb to notice. If you're going to kill him and go to prison and only see your kids on Saturday afternoons, you better understand why you're doing it. Not because he was at Selena, but because he fooled you. That finally put a damper on me. The inside eye didn't close, but it dimmed down and lost a little of its power. I tried to open my hand and let that chunk of rock maple fall, but I'd been squeezing it too tight and couldn't seem to let it go. I had to reach over with my other hand and pry the first 2 fingers off before it dropped back into the wood box, and the other 3 fingers stayed curled like they were still holding on. I had to flex my hand 3 or 4 times before it started to feel normal again. After it did, I walked over to Joe and tapped him on the shoulder. "I want to talk to you," I says. "So talk," he says from behind the paper. "I ain't stopping you." "I want you looking at me when I do," I says. "Put that rag down." He dropped the paper into his lap and looked at me. "Ain't you got the busiest mouth on you these days," he says. "I'll take care of my mouth," I says. "You just want to take care of your hands. If you don't, they're going to get you in more trouble than you could handle in a year of Sundays." His brows went up, and he asked me what that was supposed to mean. "It means I want you to leave Selena alone," I says. He looked like I'd hoiked my knee right up into his family jewels. That was the best of a sorry business, Andy. The look on Joe's face when he found out he was found out. His skin went pale, and his mouth dropped open, and his whole body kind of jerked in that shitty old rocker of his, the way a person's body will jerk sometimes when they are just falling off to sleep and have a bad thought on the way down. He tried to pass it off by acting like he'd had a muscle twinge in his back, but he didn't fool either one of us. He actually looked a little ashamed of himself, too. But that didn't win him any favor with me. Even a stupid hound dog has sense enough to look ashamed if you catch it stealing eggs out of a hen house. "I don't know what you're talking about," he says. "Then how come you look like the devil just reached into your pants and squeezed your balls?" I asked him. The thunder started to come onto his brow then. "If that damned Joe Jr.'s been telling lies about me," he begun. "Joe Jr. ain't been saying yes, no, I, nor maybe about you," I says. "And you can just drop the act, Joe. Selena told me. She told me everything. How she tried to be nice to you after the night I hit you with the cream pitcher, how you repaid her, and what you said would happen if she ever told." "She's a little liar," he says, throwing his paper on the floor like that proved it. "A little liar and a goddamn tease. I'm going to get my belt, and when she shows her face again, if she ever dares to show it around here again..." He started to get up. I took one hand and shoved him back down again. It's awful easy shoving a person who's trying to get out of a rocking chair. It surprised me a little how easy it was. Of course, I'd almost bashed his head in with a stove link not 3 minutes before, and that might have had something to do with it. His eyes went down to narrow little slits, and he said I'd better not fool with him. "You've done it before," he says, "but that don't mean you can bell the cat every time you want to." I'd been thinking that very thing myself, and not so long before, but that wasn't hardly the time to tell him so. "You can save your big talk for your friends," I says instead. "What you want to do right now isn't talk, but listen. And hear what I say, because I mean every word. If you ever fool with Selena again, I'll see you in state prison for molesting a child or statutory rape Whichever charge will keep you in cold storage the longest. That flummoxed him. His mouth fell open again, and he just sat there for a minute, staring up at me. "You'd never," he begun, and then stopped, because he seen that I would. So he went into a pet, with his lower lip pooching out farther than ever. "You take her part, don't you?" he says. "You never even asked for my side of it, Dolores." "Do you have one?" I asked him back. When a 40-year-old man asks his 14-year-old daughter to take off her underpants so he can see how much hair she has growing on her pussy, can you say that man has a side? "She'll be 15 next month," he says. As if that somehow changed everything. He was a piece of work, all right. "Do you hear yourself?" I asked him. "Do you hear what's running out of your own mouth?" He stared at me a little longer, then bent over and picked his newspaper up off the floor. "Leave me alone, Dolores," he says in his best, sulky, poor old me voice. "I want to finish this article." I felt like tearing the damn paper out of his hands and throwing it in his face. But there would have been a blood-flowing tussle for sure if I had, and I didn't want the kids, especially not little Pete, coming in on something like that. So I just reached out and pulled down the top of it, gentle, with my thumb. "First, you're going to promise me you'll leave Selena alone," I said, "so we can put this shit-miserable business behind us. You promise me you ain't going to touch her that way ever again in your life." "Dolores, you ain't," he starts. "Promise, Joe, or I'll make your life hell." "You think that scares me?" he shouts. "You've made my life hell for the last 15 years, you bitch. Your ugly face can't hold a candle to your ugly disposition. If you don't like the way I am, blame yourself." "You don't know what hell is," I said. "But if you don't promise to leave her alone, I'll see you find out." "All right," he yells. "All right, I promise. There, done. Are you satisfied?" "Yes," I says, although I wasn't. He wasn't ever going to be able to satisfy me again. It wouldn't have mattered if he'd worked the miracle of the loaves and fishes. I meant to get the kids out of that house or see him dead before the turn of the year. Which way it went didn't make much difference to me, but I didn't want him to know something was coming his way until it was too late for him to do anything about it. "Good," he says. "Then we're all done and buttoned up, ain't we, Dolores?" But he was looking at me with a funny little gleam in his eyes that I didn't much like. "You think you're pretty smart, don't you?" "I dunno," I says. "I used to think I had a fair amount of intelligence, but look who I ended up keeping house with." "Oh, come on," he says, still looking at me in that funny half-wise way. "You think you're such hot shit, you probably look over your shoulder to make sure your ass ain't smoking before you wipe yourself. But you don't know everything." "What do you mean by that?" "You figure it out," he says, and shakes his paper out like some rich guy who wants to make sure the stock market didn't use him too bad that day. "It shouldn't be no trouble for a smarty pants like you." I didn't like it, but I let it go. Partly it was because I didn't want to spend any more time knocking a stick against a hornet's nest than I had to. But that wasn't all of it. I did think I was smart, smarter than him anyway. And that was the rest of it. I figured if he tried to get his own back on me, I'd see what he was up to about 5 minutes after he got started. It was pride, in other words. Pride pure and simple. And the idea that he'd already got started never crossed my mind. When the kids came back from the store, I sent the boys into the house and walked around to the back with Selena. There's a big tangle of blackberry bushes there, mostly bare by that time of the year. A little breeze had come up, and it made them rattle. It was a lonesome sound, a little creepy, too. There's a big white stone sticking out of the ground there, and we sat down on it. A half moon had risen over East Head, and when she took my hands, her fingers were just as cold as that half moon looked. "I don't dare go in, Mommy," she said, and her voice was trembling. "I'll go to Tanya's, all right? Please say I can. You don't have to be afraid of a thing, sweetheart, I says. It's all taken care of. I don't believe you, she whispered, although her face said she wanted to. Her face said she wanted to believe it more than anything. It's true, I said. He's promised to leave you alone. He doesn't always keep his promises, but he'll keep this one, now that he knows I'm watching, and he can't count on you to keep quiet. Also, he's scared to death.
Scared to death? Why?
Because I told him I'd see him in Shawshank if he got up to any more nasty business with you. She gasped, and her hands bore down on mine again.
Marnie, you didn't.
Yes, I did, and I meant it, I says. Best for you to know that, Selina. But I wouldn't worry too much. Joe probably won't come within 10 feet of you for the next 4 years, and by then you'll be in college. If there's one thing on this round world he respects, it's his own hide. She let go of my hands, slow but sure. I saw the hope coming into her face, and something else as well. It was like her youth was coming back to her. And it wasn't until then, sitting in the moonlight by the blackberry patch with her, that I realized how old she'd come to look that fall.
He won't strap me or anything? She asked.
No, I says, it's done. Then she believed it all and put her head down on my shoulder and started to cry. Those were tears of relief, pure and simple. That she should have to cry that way made me hate Joe even more. I think that for the next few nights there was a girl in my house sleeping better than she had for 3 months or more. But I laid awake. I'd listen to Joe snoring beside me and look at him with that inside eye and feel like turning over and biting his goddamn throat out. But I wasn't crazy anymore, like I'd been when I almost poleaxed him with that stick of stove wood, thinking of the kids and what would happen to 'em if I was taken up for murder. Hadn't had any power over that inside eye then. But later on, after I'd told Selina she was safe and had a chance to cool off a little myself, it did. Still, I knew that what Selina most likely wanted, for things to go on like what her dad had been up to, had never happened. Couldn't be. Even if he kept his promise and never touched her again, that couldn't be. And in spite of what I'd told Selina, I wasn't completely sure he'd keep his promise. Sooner or later, men like Joe usually persuade themselves that they can get away with it next time. That if they're only a little more careful, they can have whatever they like. Lying there in the dark and calm again at last, the answer seemed simple enough. I had to take the kids and move to the mainland, and I had to do it soon. I was calm enough right then, but I knew I wasn't going to stay that way. That inside eye wouldn't let me. The next time I got hot, it would see even better, and Joe would look even uglier, and there might not be any thought on earth that could keep me from doing it. It was a new way of being mad, at least for me, and I was just wise enough to see the damage it could do if I let it. I had to get us away from Little Tall before that madness could break all the way out. And when I made my first move in that direction, I found out what that funny, half-wise look in his eyes meant. Did I ever? I waited a while for things to settle. Then I took the 11 o'clock ferry across to the mainland one Friday morning. The kids were in school, and Joe was out on the bounding main with Alan Stargill and his brother Gordon, playing with the lobster pots. He wouldn't be back till almost sundown. I had the kids' savings account passbooks with me. We'd been putting money away for their college ever since they were born. I had, anyway. Joe didn't give a squitter if they went to college or not. Whenever the subject came up, and it was always me who brought it up, of course, he'd most likely be sitting there in his shitty rocker with his face hid behind the Ellsworth American, and he'd poke it out just long enough to say, "Why in Christ's name are you so set on sending those kids to college, Dolores? I never went, and I did all right." Well, there's some things you just can't argue with, ain't there? If Joe thought that reading the paper, mining for boogers, and wiping them on the runners of his rocking chair was doing all right, there wasn't no room at all for discussion. It was hopeless from the word go. That was all right, though. As long as I could keep making him kick in his fair share if he happened to fall into something good, like when he got on the county road crew. I didn't give a shit if he thought every college in the country was run by the commies. The winter he worked on the road crew on the mainland, I got him to put $500 in their bank accounts, and he whined like a pup, said I was taking all his dividend. I knew better, though, Andy. If that son of a whore didn't make $2,000, maybe $2,500 that winter, I'll smile and kiss a pig. "Why do you always want to nag me so, Dolores?" he'd ask. "If you were man enough to do what's right for your kids in the first place, I wouldn't have to," I'd tell him. And around it'd go, blah, blah, blah-de-blah. I got pretty sick of it from time to time, Andy. But I almost always got out of him what I thought the kids had coming. I couldn't get too sick of it to do that, because they didn't have nobody else to make sure their future'd still be there for 'em when they got to it. There wasn't a lot in those three accounts by today's standards. 2,000 or so in Selena's, about 800 in Joe Jr.'s, 400 or 500 in Little Pete's. But this is 1962 I'm talking about, and in those days it was a fairish chunk of change. More than enough to get away on, that was for sure. I figured to draw Little Pete's in cash and take cashier's checks for the other two. I decided to make a clean break and move us all the way down to Portland, find a place to live and a decent job. We wasn't none of us used to city living, but people can get used to damn near anything if they have to. Besides, Portland wasn't really much more than a big town back then, not like it is now. Once I got settled, I could start putting back the money I'd had to take, and I thought I could do it. Even if I couldn't, they was bright kids, and I knew there was such things as scholarships. If they missed out on those, I decided I wasn't too proud to fill out a few loan applications. The major thing was to get them away. Right then, doing that seemed a lot more important than college. First things first, as the bumper sticker on Joe's old formal tractor used to say. I've run my gums for pretty near 3/4 of an hour about Selena, but it wasn't only her who'd suffered from him. She got the worst of it, but there was plenty of black weather left over for Joe Jr. He was 12 in 1962, a prime age for a boy, but you wouldn't know it looking at him. He hardly ever smiled or laughed any more. And it really wasn't any wonder. He'd no more than come into the room and his dad'd be on him like a weasel on a chicken, telling him to tuck in his shirt, to comb his hair, to quit slouching, to grow up, stop acting like a goddamn sissy with his nose always stuck in a book, to be a man. When Joe Jr. didn't make the Little League All-Star team the summer before I found out what was wrong with Selena, you would have thought, listening to his father, that he'd been kicked off the Olympic track team for taking pep pills. Add to that whatever he'd seen his father getting up to with his big sister, and you got a real mess on your hands, Sonny Jim. I'd sometimes look at Joe Jr. looking at his father and see real hate in that boy's face. Hate, pure and simple. And during the week or two before I went across to the mainland with those passbooks in my pocket, I realized that when it came to his father, Joe Jr. had his own inside eye. Then there was little Pete, the apple of his dad's eye. By the time he was 4... he'd go swaggering around right behind Joe with the waist of his pants pulled up like Joe wore his, and he'd pull at the end of his nose and his ears just like Joe did. Little Pete didn't have any hairs there to pull, of course, so he'd just pretend. On his first day at first grade, he came home sniveling, with dirt on the seat of his pants and a scratch on his cheek. I sat down beside him on the porch step, put my arm around his shoulders, and asked him what happened. He said that goddamn little sheeny Dickie O'Hara pushed him down. I told him goddamn was swearing and he shouldn't say it, then asked him if he knew what a sheeny was. I was pretty curious to hear what might pop out of his mouth, to tell you the truth. "Sure I do," he says. "A sheeny's a stupid jerk like Dickie O'Hara." I told him no, he was wrong, and he asked me what it did mean then. I told him to never mind. It wasn't a nice word, and I didn't want him saying it any more. He just sat there glaring at me with his lip pooched out. He looked just like his old man. Selena was scared of her father. Joe Jr. hated him. but in some ways it was Little Pete who scared me the most, because Little Pete wanted to grow up to be just like him. So I got their passbooks from the bottom drawer of my little jewelry box. I kept them there because it was the only thing I had in those days with a lock on it. I wore the key around my neck on a chain, and walked into the Coastal Northern Bank in Jonesport at about 12:30. When I got to the front of the line, I pushed the passbooks across to the teller, said I meant to close all three accounts out, and explained how I wanted the money. "That'll be just a moment, Mrs. St. George," she says, and goes to the back of the teller's area to pull the accounts. This was long before computers, of course, and they had to do a lot more fiddling and diddling. She got 'em. I saw her pull all three, and then she opened 'em up and looked at 'em. A little line showed up down the middle of her brow, and she said something to one of the other women. Then they both looked for a while, with me standing out there on the other side of the counter, watching 'em and telling myself there wasn't a reason in the world to feel nervous, and feeling pretty goddamn nervous just the same. Then, instead of coming back to me, the teller went into one of those jumped-up little cubbyholes they called offices. It had glass sides, and I could see her talking to a little bald man in a gray suit and a black tie. When she came back to the counter, she didn't have the account files anymore. She'd left them on the bald fella's desk. "I think you'd better discuss your children's savings account with Mr. Pease, Mrs. St. George," she says, and pushes the passbooks back to me. She did it with the side of her hand, like they were germy and she might get infected if she touched them too much or too long. "Why?" I asked. "What's wrong with them?" By then I'd given up the notion that I didn't have anything to feel nervous about. My heart was rapping away double time in my chest and my mouth had gone all dry. "Really, I couldn't say. But I'm sure that if there's a misunderstanding, Mr. Pease will straighten it right out," she says. But she wouldn't look me in the eye, and I could tell she didn't think any such thing. I walked to that office like I had a 20-pound cake of cement on each foot. I already had a pretty good idea of what must have happened, but I didn't see how in the world it could have happened. Gory, I had the passbooks, didn't I? Joe hadn't got them out of my jewelry box and then put them back either, because the lock would have been busted, and it wasn't. Even if he'd picked it somehow, which is a laugh, that man couldn't get a fork full of peas from his plate to his mouth without dropping half of them in his lap. The passbooks would either show the withdrawals or be stamped account closed in the red ink the bank uses, and they didn't show neither one. Just the same, I knew that Mr. Pease was going to tell me my husband had been up to fuckery, and once I got into his office, that was just what he did tell me. He said that Joe Jr.'s and Little Pete's accounts had been closed out 2 months ago, and Selena's less than 2 weeks ago. Joe had done it when he did because he knew I never put money in their accounts after Labor Day until I thought I had enough squirreled away in the big soup kettle on the top kitchen shelf to take care of the Christmas bills. Pease showed me those green sheets of ruled paper accountants use, and I saw Joe had scooped out the last big chunk, $500 from Selena's account. The day after, I told him I knew what he'd been up to with her, and he sat there in his rocker and told me I didn't know everything. He sure was right about that. I went over the figures 6 times, and when I looked up, Mr. Pease was sitting across from me, rubbing his hands together and looking worried. I could see little drops of sweat on his bald head. He knew what had happened as well as I did. "As you can see, Mrs. St. George, those accounts have been closed out by your husband, and..." "How can that be?" I asks him. I threw the three passbooks down on his desk. They made a whacking noise, and he kind of blinked his eyes and jerked back. "How can that be, when I got the Chrysler savings account books right here?" "Well," he says, licking his lips and blinking like a lizard sunning itself on a hot rock, "you see, Mrs. St. George, those were what we call custodial savings accounts. That means the child in whose name the account is held could draw from it with either you or your husband to countersign. It also means that either of you can, as parents, draw from any of these three accounts when and as you like, as you would have done today if the money had still, been in the accounts. But these don't show any goddamn withdrawals, I says. And I must have been shouting, because people in the bank were looking around at us. I could see them through the glass walls. Not that I cared. How'd he get the money without the goddamn passbooks? He was rubbing his hands together faster and faster. They made a sandpapery kind of sound. And if he'd had a dry stick between them, I believe he could have set fire to the gum wrappers in his ashtray. Mrs. St. George, if I could ask you to keep your voice down. I'll worry about my voice, I says, louder than ever. You worry about the way this beshitted bank does business, chummy. The way it looks to me, you got a lot to worry about. He took a sheet of paper off his desk and looked at it. According to this, your husband stated the passbooks were lost, he says finally. He asked to be issued new ones. It's a common enough. Common be damned, I yelled. You never called me. No one from the bank called me. Those accounts were held between the two of us. That's how it was explained to me when we opened Selina's and Joe Jr.'s back in 51, and it was still the same when we opened Peter's in 54. You want to tell me the rules have been changed since then? Mrs. St. George, he started. But he might as well have tried whistling through a mouthful of crackers. I meant to have my say. He told you a fairy story and you believed it. Asked for new passbooks and you gave them to him. Gory sakes. Who the hell do you think put that money in the bank to begin with? If you think it was Joe St. George, you're a lot dumber than you look. By then, everybody in the bank had quit even pretending to be going about their business. They just stood where they were looking at us. Most of them must have thought it was a pretty good show, too, judging by the expressions on their faces. But I wonder if they would have been quite so entertained if it had been their kids' college money that had just flown away like a big-ass bird. Mr. Pease had gone as red as the side of old Dad's barn. Even his sweaty old bald head had turned bright red. "Please, Mrs. St. George," he says. By then he was looking like he might break down and cry. "I assure you that what we did was not only perfectly legal, but standard bank practice." I lowered my voice then. I could feel all the fight running out of me. Joe had fooled me all right, fooled me good. And this time I didn't have to wait for it to happen twice to say shame on me. "Maybe it's legal, and maybe it ain't," I says. "I'd have to haul you into court to find out one way or the other, wouldn't I? And I ain't got either the time or the money to do it. Besides, it ain't the question what's legal or what ain't that's knocked me for a loop here. It's how you never once thought that someone else might be concerned about what happened to that money. Don't standard bank practice ever allow you folks to make a single goddamn phone call? I mean, the number's right there on all those forms, and it ain't changed. Mrs. St. George, I'm very sorry, but if it had been the other way around," I says, "if I'd been the one with a story about how the passbooks was lost and asked for new ones, if I'd been the one who started drawing out what took 11 or 12 years to put in, would you have called Joe? If the money had still been here for me to withdraw today, like I came in meaning to do, wouldn't you have called him the minute I stepped out the door to let him know, just as a courtesy, mind you, what his wife had been up to? Because I'd expected just that, Andy. That was why I'd picked a day when he was out with the Stargills. I'd expected to go back to the island, collect the kids, and be long gone before Joe come up the driveway with a six-pack in one hand and his dinner pail in the other." Pease looked at me and opened his mouth. Then he closed it again and didn't say nothing. He didn't have to. The answer was right there on his face. Of course he, or someone else from the bank, would have called Joe and kept on trying until he finally got him. Why? Because Joe was the man of the house, that's why. And the reason nobody had bothered to tell me was because I was just his wife. What the hell was I supposed to know about money except how to earn some, down on my knees, scrubbing floors and baseboards and toilet bowls. If the man of the house decided to draw out all his kids' college money, he must have had a damn good reason. And even if he didn't, it didn't matter, because he was the man of the house and in charge. His wife was just a little woman, and all she was in charge of was baseboards, toilet bowls, and chicken dinners on Sunday afternoons. "If there's a problem, Mrs. St. George," Pease was saying, "I'm very sorry, but if you say you're sorry one more time, I'll kick your butt up so high you'll look like a hunchback," I says. But there was no real danger of me doing anything to him. Right about then, I didn't feel like I had enough strength to kick a beer can across the road. "Just tell me one thing, and I'll get out of your hair. Is the money spent?" "I would have no way of knowing," he says in this prissy little shocked voice. You'd have thought I'd told him I'd show him mine if he showed me his. "This is the bank Joe's done business with his whole life," I says. "He could have gone down the road to Machias or Columbia Falls and stuck it in one of those banks, but he didn't. He's too dumb and lazy and set in his ways. No, he's either stuck it in a couple of mason jars and buried it somewhere or put it right back in here. That's what I want to know, if my husband's opened some kind of new account here in the last couple of months." Except it felt more like I had to know, Andy. Finding out how bad he'd fooled me made me feel sick to my stomach, and that was bad. But not knowing if he'd pissed it all away somehow, that was killing me. "If he's... that's privileged information," he says. And by then you'd have thought I'd told him I'd touch his if he'd touch mine. "Yeah," I says, "figured it was. I'm asking you to break a rule. I know just looking at you that you're not a man who does that often. I can see it runs against your grain. But that was my kid's money, Mr. Pease, and he lied to get it. You know he did. The proof's right there on your desk blotter. It's a lie that wouldn't have worked if this bank, your bank, had had the common courtesy to make a telephone call." He clears his throat and starts. "We are not required." "I know you ain't," I says. I wanted to grab him and shake him, but I saw it wouldn't do no good, not with a man like him. Besides, my mother always said you can catch more flies with honey than you ever can with vinegar, and I found it to be true. "I know that. But think of the grief and heartache you'd have saved me with that one call. And if you'd like to make up for some of it, I know you don't have to, but if you'd like to, please tell me if he's opened an account here, or if I've got to start digging holes around my house. Please, I'll never tell. I swear on the name of God I won't." He sat there looking at me, drumming his fingers on those green accountant sheets. His nails were all clean, and it looked like he'd had a professional manicure. Although I guess that ain't too likely. It's Jonesport in 1962 we're talking about, after all. I suppose his wife did it. Those nice, neat nails made little muffled thumps on the papers each time they came down, and I thought, he ain't gonna do nothing for me. Not a man like him. What's he care about island folk and their problems? His ass is covered, and that's all he cares about. So when he did speak up, I felt ashamed for what I'd been thinking about men in general and him in particular. "I can't check something like that with you sitting right here, Mrs. St. George," he says. "Why don't you go down to the Chatty Buoy and order yourself a cruller and a nice hot cup of coffee? You look like you could use something. I'll join you in 15 minutes. No, better make it half an hour." "Thank you," I said. "Thank you so very much." He sighed and began shuffling the papers back together. "I must be losing my mind," he says, then laughed kind of nervous-like. "No," I told him, "you're helping a woman who don't have nowhere else to turn, that's all. Ladies in distress have always been a weakness of mine," he says. "Give me half an hour, maybe even a little longer. But you'll come?" "Yes," he said, "I will." He did, too, but it was closer to 45 minutes than half an hour. And by the time he finally got to the buoy, I'd pretty well made up my mind he was going to leave me in the lurch. Then, when he finally came in, I thought he had bad news. I thought I could read it in his face.